wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. And I wish I was.
Good morning. You're listening to KBOO Portland, Portland's community-owned and democratically run radio station. Welcome to the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Tom Becker. Patsy Kohlberg is engineering. The Old Mole is dedicated to bringing you different perspectives on history, culture, politics, and current events than that of the corporate compromised news media. Today is Labor Day. I should say it's Labor Day if you live in the United States, Canada, or Puerto Rico. For most of the rest of the world, Labor Day falls in on May 1st. Herein lays an apparent irony. For the May 1st date adopted by most of the world to acknowledge and honor labor is a commemoration of a labor struggle that took place right here in the good old USA. May 1st was first designated as a day to honor labor in 1889 by the Second International in remembrance of an event that has become known as the Haymarket Affair. The year was 1886. Chicago workers were demanding an 8-hour workday, and in the first week of May called for a strike. The strike began peacefully but turned violent, with the police firing into the crowd and killing several workers. There's a lot more to the story, and if you're interested, you can look it up online. The story I want to tell today is how we here in the U.S. wound up with the first Monday in September date, when almost everyone else in the world commemorates labor on May 1st, in recognition of an historic labor struggle that occurred right here. This apparent irony can quickly be resolved. It is, in fact, for that very history I've outlined above, that we do not celebrate Labor Day with the rest of the world. For the 1894 U.S. Congress, which magnanimously gave workers today's Labor Day, sought specifically to repress our historical memory of just these sorts of events in which workers fought and died fighting for a fair share of the rewards from their own productivity. It's no wonder, then, that Congress chose the September date. It was chosen for no other reason than it made a nice break between the 4th of July and Thanksgiving holidays. If today's workforce, largely non-unionized, and a significant segment, even anti-union, had any idea of the struggles that workers of a bygone era went through to organize and establish fair labor conditions that today we take for granted, such as the 8-hour workday, they should fall to their knees in gratitude, and perhaps even, as workers and labor unions continue to lose ground in today's international capitalist economy, once again take up the struggle in earnest.
There's an evening haze settling over town, starlight by the edge of the creek. The buying power of the proletariat's gone down, money's getting shallow and weak. Well, the place I love best is a sweet memory, it's a new path that we trod. They say low wages are reality if we want to compete abroad. My cruel weapons have been put on the shelf. Come sit down on my knees. You are dearer to me than myself, as you yourself can see. While I'm listening to the steel rails hum, got both eyes tight shut, just sitting here trying to keep the hunger from creeping its way into my gut. Meet me at the bottom, don't lag behind. Bring me my boots and shoes. You can hang back or fight your best on the front line. Sing a little bit of these working blues.
We'll be talking more about labor and labor organizers on today's program. Desiree Helliger talks with Professor Mario Cifuentes about his book, Of Forests and Fields, Mexican Labor in the Pacific Northwest, and about the groundbreaking organizing work of the Oregon Farmworkers Union, PACUN. Fran Michelle shares some thoughts from an article by John Bellamy Foster entitled The Meaning of Work in a Sustainable Society. Leading off today's program, Bill Resnick talks with Mark Bray. Mark Bray is an historian of human rights, terrorism, and political radicalism in modern Europe and the U.S. They begin by talking about the potential rise of fascism, both here and abroad, and how to stop it. Bill?
Mark Bray, welcome to KABU.
Thank you.
Mark Bray is a historian of human rights, terrorism, political radicalism in modern Europe and the United States. He's an activist. He writes a lot. His first book was Translating Anarchy, The Anarchism of Occupy Wall Street. And his new book, The Anti-Fascist Handbook, it'll be available in less than a month, say, your publisher. Is that right, Mark, or have they put it off?
Yeah, pushed back a little, early September, but pretty soon.
Mark Bray, I've read several of your articles in Roar magazine. It's an anarchist internet journal. You eloquently contend that fascism in this country is a real threat. It has to be stopped. And you point out, and I quote here, to resist this growing reality, we need a comprehensive anti-fascist strategy that includes explicitly anti-fascist organizing and a recognition of how ultimately the bases of support for both fascism and anti-fascism are formed by the societal norms of political and ethical behavior that develop over generations of struggle. I couldn't agree more. With that in mind, you continue, we can orient our resistance to both capital F fascists and what you call everyday fascists that empower them, feed off their hateful energy, and, quoting you again, and all too often carry out the violent deeds that the ideologues, the capital F fascists, I think you're referring to, advocate. So, Mark, you emphasize the political, social, ethical struggles in daily life, at least in those essays. But you also contend in the essays that the struggle and the force in that struggle, force and violence are in some conditions justified and needed. But at least in those essays, you don't specify those conditions. And I hope in this interview we can specify the conditions at the end. But first, please discuss why you see the struggle in daily life as primary.
Well, I think that in understanding fascism and anti-fascism, it's important to understand how the fascist regimes of the past and the racist and oppressive ideas that they promote had broad bases of popular support. So immediately after World War II, there were a lot of narratives going around Germany and Italy and countries in Europe that the vast majority of the population were sort of essentially held hostage by the fascist regimes, and that in a country like Nazi Germany, anyone who spoke out or did anything outside of the norm whatsoever ran the risk of being killed. But recent historical research has shown that the vast majority of non-Jewish, non-leftist, non-homosexual Germans really had very minimal fear about the government and often broke minor laws on a regular basis without fear of reprisal. And what this shows is that in order to really uproot fascism, in order to prevent it from growing, and in order to isolate and marginalize white supremacist Klansmen and fascists and so forth, it's important to not only think about their explicit organizing, but the reception that kind of organizing and the reception that those kinds of ideas have in society and how they can embolden people who don't necessarily identify with any of these ideologies or any of these oppressive views per se, but yet are influenced by them in being bigoted, in being hateful in everyday ways. So to try and think of the sort of relationship between the everyday, between the interactions we have with our coworkers, our neighbors, our friends, all the way up through how that can feed off of and reinforce fascist organizing. Yeah. So from an anti-fascist perspective, what I argue in these essays is that we need to think of not only anti-fascism in an organized political sense, but also allow certain ideas about anti-fascism to influence how we interact with people in our daily lives. And to understand that an important aspect of anti-fascism, whether in an everyday or in a political sense, is essentially, as I phrase it, not having any tolerance for intolerance, for saying that if we want a just society, we really can't look the other way when people are racist, when people are transphobic, homophobic, misogynist, and so forth. And the other part of it, the sort of illiberal aspect of this politics, is to say that when people are racist or misogynist or so forth, it's not just a question of changing their minds, although we want to do that and that's ideal and that can happen, but that behavior changes don't, I think, as commonly stem from changing people's opinions so much as it is creating sort of bulwarks against racist behavior that make people feel awkward, uncomfortable, embarrassed, make it feel inappropriate to act this way in public, and that these kinds of social norms, these taboos, if you will, really shape the acceptable realms within which people form their opinions. And that kind of illiberal shifting of the sort of terms by which everyday interactions reinforce or combat fascism is sort of what I'm talking about with that.
You want to make it very uncomfortable for people who are not really committed to some of the sort of the fascist ideas, but in fact find some of them attractive, and you want them to realize that these things are unacceptable, that they're going to feel shame, that people are going to see them as crude and useless and without a sense of decency. And therefore, they're just not going to utter that sort of stuff or join in any kind of oppressive behavior.
But the other thing I would add on to that is, number one, it's to keep it out of the public sphere and make it not acceptable. But the other thing is that I think that if we look at a sort of a macro perspective generationally, that the sort of boundaries that we put on the ability of people to be outwardly racist or outwardly misogynist do over time from a generational perspective affect people's actual opinions and not just keep them in the closet. That would be the other
part
of the argument.
Right. Well, there's a sort of cognitive dissonance, and that opens the way for, in fact, talking to people and developing a whole set of other ideas. In fact, I think everyday racism is everywhere, but everyday anti-racism is everywhere, and sometimes in the same people, depending on the situation and how they view things. And people then can be moved and become committed to a anti-racist, anti-oppressive politics. I think you were sort of arguing that. I think that's actually true. Now, the question is, of course, how to be anti-racist in everyday life. And you pointed that out. I don't think we can go into it. You just challenge people who are acting in racist ways, like the people on the MAX train in Portland who got killed. But in fact, they were not just heroic. They sort of did their duty as human beings. And,
entirely.
Of course, they paid for it, but that's part of our obligations as social actors and in solidarity with others to, in fact, not let that everyday racism surface. And you can't allow oppression in your presence. So sometimes you also have to interfere with an arrest. The police call it interference, but just sort of argue against it and point out to the police that you shouldn't. There's a lot of ways in which we can take... It sometimes is risky, but in fact, it's absolutely necessary. And if you don't do it, you're going to hate yourself. At least that's how I feel. Sometimes you do things and you're sort of hesitant and worried, but in fact, it's much worse not to, in fact, act according to your principles.
Yeah, basically, we all have a role to play in making the world how we want it to be.
This is Bill Resnick for The Old Mole. I've been talking to Mark Bray, who's a historian. He's done much of his work on fascism and anti-fascism and how to stop the fascists. We've been talking about his conception, which I think is very valuable, of everyday anti-fascism, which is really mostly doing actions that make the being in daily life and challenging the oppressive practices when we see them in almost every situation. If you're at work and your boss acts that way, maybe you challenge the boss in one way or another. There are worse things than being fired. And when particularly other workers do, or friends do, and there are so many ways of actually reinforcing oppressive ideas, and you have to call people on them. Bad jokes just can't go unchallenged. It can be done, though, in ways that are social and winning rather than being totally confrontational. But you have to do it. I think that's the point you're making. And there's much more. The issue I want to first raise is you talk about the need for violence and force. You don't specify what the conditions for using force to humiliate the fascists. Right now, we really outnumber them by a lot. And you think that there are conditions where using force is a good idea, like punching Richard Spencer in the nose. You talk about that in a sort of a favorable way without promoting a lot of punching in the nose. But you don't challenge it. And I think that there are conditions where some kinds of force are necessary to humiliate them. But violence can rebound against us. It can be extremely damaging to do violence, and there's a number of ways, and I'd like you to talk about it, like the conditions. I'm not worried about Richard Spencer's nose, but when is it that violence, force and use of force, and you can use force without violence, incidentally, which is what I would like to promote, that we be forceful, that we humiliate them, that we show up at their rallies and force them to get police escorts. What can be more humiliating than watching 30 of them walking through a neighborhood with 100 police around them because the crowds are very large and are heckling them, but are not, in fact, beating them up or particularly not trying to beat the police up or throw things at them? There's less of that than goes on, but there's still too much, it seems to me. The media really focus on that, of course, and throwing things at the police, try and get pictures or burning ash cans. So tell us about how you think about violence.
So I think that the conversation about violence and anti-fascism has to make a few things clear in the beginning. One is that the majority of what anti-fascists do is nonviolent, that anti-fascists put a lot of time into researching the far right, into learning where they work, where they live, informing their neighbors, into organizing educational events, popular propaganda campaigns, and any number of things, and that the violence gets a disproportionate amount of attention because it's sensational. The second thing is I think that it's important to think of it historically and to take a look back at the period prior to World War II when fascism was ascendant in Europe, Nazism was ascendant, and really think about how the liberal prescription for dealing with fascism and Nazism ultimately was insufficient in those countries. So the liberal prescription is essentially to have faith in the institutions of parliamentary government to forestall a fascist advance, to have faith in the police to stop the fascists if they do something illegal, and have faith in the power of rational argumentation and, in certain variants, human decency to essentially prevent the kind of irrational violence of Nazism and fascism from advancing. And we can see historically that those were insufficient to stop them, and they were ultimately stopped by tanks and guns and so forth. So the question is, considering that we cannot count on parliamentary government and rationality to stop fascism and Nazism 100% of the time, what else can we do? And so sometimes when these conversations, what ends up happening is the people who are opposed to using violence against fascists will essentially argue that it's only acceptable once they get into government. The anti-fascist response is that you don't wait for them to take power, you don't wait for another genocide or another dictatorial regime to emerge before you use whatever means are necessary to stop them. For example, in 1919, Mussolini's initial fascist corps was about 100 people, and so there was no reason at the time for the Italian left to pay attention to Mussolini's 100 fascists, but one couldn't help but imagine what might have happened if they had and stopped them before they could become a threat. And so the question is, if violence is okay against Nazis or fascists when there's a genocide or when there's a war, what about when they're initially in power? What about when they are a mass party and they're ascendant? Well, the argument anti-fascists put forward, which people will agree or disagree with, is that you don't even let them take the first step, considering the horrors of what they promoted. And the other thing to recognize is that much anti-fascist violence is also in self-defense. If we look at the origins of a modern anti-fascism in the U.S., in Europe, in the 80s and 90s, it often grew out of situations where there were developments of white power skinhead gangs in the punk rock scene or in other alternative subcultures that were attacking local leftists, people of color, and so forth. And so you can't entirely talk about the question of violence without the question of self-defense. And in Europe, quite often, this kind of anti-fascist self-defense is a prerequisite for other forms of organizing. So for research for my book, Antifa, the Anti-Fascist Handbook, which, as you mentioned, is coming out in September, I spoke to, for example, Swedish immigrant rights organizers who have talked about having their demonstrations attacked by neo-Nazis with broken bottles and knives and the need for anti-fascists to defend these demonstrations when the police were insufficient or absent.
When the police were insufficient and absent. Yes, of course. In fact, you have to defend them even when the police are there. But in fact, the police in Germany did, in fact, protect the immigrants. Now, there were a lot of bombings. Germany had a huge fascist presence 10 or 15 years ago. And in fact, we found ourselves having to rely on the constitutionalism of the police and the German government to stop them. And in the United States, that's happened too. Our jails are full of white supremacists, sometimes just for drug crimes and the rest of it.
Now, the record of the German government and the police since the fall of the Berlin Wall has been mixed, right? So in the early 90s, there were waves of anti-immigrant violence that the police often looked the other way on, and some of the most active defenders of immigrants were some of the autonomous anti-fascists of the era. You're right, though, that the German government has at times seriously clamped down on certain white supremacists and certain neo-Nazi groups and so forth. But even recently, with the quote-unquote immigrant crisis, as the right calls it, of the last few years, I spoke to some anti-fascists who had to go out to Dresden and go out to Heidenau in eastern Germany and stand shoulder to shoulder with Syrian and other immigrants defending themselves against fascism.
There's no question that that's necessary. Yeah. But the question is, how do we deal with the police? My reading of Germany is also very different than yours. My reading is that after the sort of liberal capitalist reform, social democrats took power in Germany after World War I, and after so many city-states were run by the soldiers and workers in democratic ways with an overall anarchist set of ideas motivating them, but they made the terrible mistake of, in fact, giving power back to the provisional government, who in fact did not try and cleanse the judiciary, the courts, the police, and the army of very reactionary sentiments. That is, the state was a reactionary state run by a group of liberals on the top who became more and more afraid of taking them on. So Hitler got, 6 months maybe in jail for treason and trying to overthrow the state in 1923, and hundreds of labor organizers and activists, anarchists and social democrats and communists, leadership, intellectuals, as well as people active in their workplace, they were assassinated by the Nazis. The Nazis were given free rein to destroy the left. And it seems to me, once you lose the state, if you have an army that's committed to reactionary ideas and police who look the other way when fascists kill people, then you're in deep, deep trouble. And my sense is that right now the state and the police are very mixed and it's contradictory. Many of them are everyday fascists, but not ideologues, and they have cognitive dissonance. They, in fact, sometimes respect the black cops that they're partnered with and all of the rest. And they act constitutionally often, like Jeremy Christian is going to be prosecuted. And so have many. Metzger, the fascist, the Ku Klux Klan of Alabama and Mississippi have been destroyed by the state. It seems to me if the state was giving them support, as of course the state did through the period of Reconstruction after the Civil War, then you're lost and you're going to go through a long period of getting killed. So it means to me you've got to really fight for a state that doesn't support the fascists, and you have to try and transform the police. And then the question of violence becomes of how we, in fact, operate with regard to the fascists and the police and the state. It becomes a very different question.
Well, it also depends on the long end game of what one is trying to accomplish or what a group is trying to accomplish. So anti-fascists are communists, anarchists, and socialists who are not only trying to stop fascism, but organize for a revolutionary rupture with the prevailing system. And so two questions sort of that are balanced at the same time. The one is, how do we stop fascism? And also a kind of critique of the ways in which crises of capitalist society promote the growth of the far right and the potentials for fascism, and the ways in which the state, even if it does sometimes clamp down on the far right, other times will open up space for the far right. As we discussed before the program started, well-documented instances of white supremacist infiltration into law enforcement, which, of course, institutionally has a white supremacist origin and history. So the question for anti-fascists is also, how do we try to build towards a post-capitalist society, and how do we dissect and analyze the relationships between capitalism, institutional white supremacy, and fascism. So people will disagree about these topics. I think historically and politically, the prospects for reforming the police are very minimal, and the notion sometimes overrides or covers up the role of the police force as the sort of guardians of the capitalist class. Instead, I think there's more potential in trying to win over rank-and-file military in sort of a situation where push comes to shove and people need to decide which side they're on. But ultimately, I think to take a step back and refer back to the first part of our conversation, the question is, how do we not only try to stop fascism, but organize in our communities, in our workplaces and societies to try to build a powerful social movement that can stop a fascist advance and also build something new? Because it can't only be about stopping and preventing. It should also be about building.
Yeah, it's too bad that we don't have another hour to talk about these things, because I entirely agree with your final statement. I hope we've provided some food for thought for people. Thanks a lot for talking to us today, Mark Bray.
Thank you so much.
And your book, The Anti-Fascist Handbook. Is that right, Mark?
Antifa, : The Anti-Fascist Handbook, Melville House, coming out early September. But you can pre-order it today on Amazon or wherever.
Thanks a lot for talking to us.
Thank you.
I'm gonna tell all you fascists, you may be surprised. People all over this world are getting organized. You're bound to lose. You fascists are bound to lose. Race hatred cannot stop us. This one thing I know, your poll tax and Jim Crow and greed have got to go. You're bound to lose. You fascists are bound to lose. All you fascists are bound to lose. You fascists are bound to lose. You fascists are bound to lose. You're bound to lose. You fascists are bound to lose.
You're listening to KBOO Portland, and this is the Old Mole Variety Hour. All You Fascists. That was a song sung by Billy Bragg. The lyrics, however, were by Woody Guthrie, but set to music by Bragg. Now Desiree Hellinger's talks with Professor Mario Cifuentes about the organizing work of the Oregon Farm Workers Union, PACUN. Dr. Cifuentes is the son of immigrant laborers from Mexico and grew up in Central Oregon. Desiree?
My guest today is Dr. Mario Cifuentes, who is Assistant Professor of History at the University of California, Merced. So we're going to be speaking today about his new book, Of Forests and Fields, Mexican Labor in the Pacific Northwest. Professor Cifuentes is the son of immigrant farm workers from Mexico, and he grew up working alongside his parents in the fields. He went on to attend the University of Oregon as an undergrad, where he was one of the founders of the Oregon Students of Color Coalition, along with Huey Ong, executive director of OPAL, and several other folks. So he has a PhD from Brown University, and his book examines, among other things, the Bracero program, waves of exploitation and expulsion, and also devotes considerable attention to the history of the Oregon Farmworkers Union, PACUN, or Piñeros y Campesinos Unidos Noroeste. And in the process of writing this book, you also, it sounds like, really stumbled upon some really interesting history of your own family.
Yeah.
Can you tell us a little bit about the book and some of the important history that you unearthed, particularly about PACUN? Because it sounds like you had the kind of the first experience of really delving into, of any researcher, really delving extensively into the PACUN archives.
The book really came about, I think, as a product of not really being able to ever find anything, right, about Mexicans in the Pacific Northwest. Most of the stuff that I had read in college was about California or about Texas, the Southwest in general, and there was really very little about the story of Mexicans in the Pacific Northwest. And as a kid, I'd always wondered how we ended up here, and as a graduate student, I started to answer that question. Part of the challenge in doing so, right, is that there was no archive of the Mexican experience in the Pacific Northwest. And so working in the state archives or working at the Oregon Historical Society, you would find things that are scattered in various different archives that were referencing Mexicans, right? That there were 120 braceros in this area, or there were 160 Mexicans in this area, or, you know, a Bureau of Labor and Industry report about migrant camps and people working in various different industries. And I started to really get kind of worried about the kind of book that I could write with the archive that existed, right? These are mostly officials and mostly Anglos talking about Mexicans and what they think about Mexicans, and not really about the lives of Mexicans themselves, right? And so what ended up happening for me that was serendipitous is that there was a grant that we had gotten through the National Endowment for the Humanities to start doing oral histories of braceros, and that's a long, complicated story. But when we started to do those oral histories, I started asking people, did you ever work in Oregon? Did you ever work in Oregon? Or did you ever work in Washington or Idaho? And eventually I had 40, 50, 60 braceros who were like, yeah, we worked in Oregon, and I interviewed them, and we would talk about, you know, their life as braceros in the Northwest and how it was different from California. And the conclusion that I ultimately came to was the distance between the border and the lack of Mexican-Americans community in the Northwest actually made the braceros much more militant and much more active than they were in other parts of the country. And so if you look at the newspapers in the 1940s here, strike after strike after bracero strike, you know? And so that was sort of a new story, right? The history of the bracero program has been one of, you know, victimization of the braceros and the terrible working conditions and, you know, the reneging on contracts and various different things that really painted a really bleak picture of the bracero program. And I think those things are all true. But that there was also what I was seeking in those archives that I couldn't find was the humanity of the people who worked in these industries and who worked in the fields and in the forests and in the railroads. And I found that through the oral history. And it kind of set off like, you know, a light bulb went off. And I was like, oh, this is how I'm going to do this book, right? I'm going to write this through oral histories. And so the next step was, okay, well, who came after the braceros? Well, the Tejanos came after the braceros, right? And the bracero program, while it ended in the Northwest in 1946, it continued until the 1960s in other parts of the country in particular. In South Texas, braceros were everywhere, right? And so they were pushing, you know, pushing wages down and pushing people out. And so the Tejano diaspora really begins with the bracero program. And so the Tejanos were going to the Northwest, they were going to Chicago, they were going to Delaware and the South and Wisconsin, you know, and those stories have only recently been starting to be written about and told. And so the same thing happens in the Northwest. You have a large Tejano community that, you know, establishes this sort of cultural, you know, sort of safety, you know, sort of these cultural communities around them, right, where they're opening carnicerías and tortillerías, and there's the first Spanish language radio station. It starts broadcasting in Yakima in the 1950s, you know, and there's dances, and there's all these ways, these other forms of resistance, right? And I had sort of gone into it as an undergrad or as a graduate student thinking there's going to be strikes, there's going to be organizing efforts, there's going to be all these things, and with the braceros it kind of dies out, and the Tejanos are the ones that start moving in. And, you know, my definition of resistance opened up, right? There was a very different kind of resistance. There was a claiming of space, right, in this incredibly overwhelmingly Anglo area, to say, you know, we're here, we're working, we're going to be here, and this is what we do, right? And so the Tejano culture really spreads really widely in the Pacific Northwest. And, you know, three decades or so, 1950s to the 1980s, the people who are in the fields are dominated by migrants, right? Internal migrants. By the 1980s, 1990s, we start to see a growth in undocumented workers, right? And so when I started saying, okay, well, now we have three really distinct waves of Mexican immigrants to the Pacific Northwest, right? Braceros, Tejanos, undocumented immigrants. And so, you know, the oral history component of that comes back into it. I started interviewing all these Tejanos, all these contractors, all these people who had been here in the 1950s and 60s. And then when I started thinking, okay, well, the next people who are coming in, the Tejanos that I'm interviewing are saying, well, we went into construction, we went into, some of them became contractors, you know, they all went into these other occupations, and in comes the undocumented workers. And so that's when I started saying, okay, well, this is the Picun part of this, right? Like, this is the work that I've been doing as an undergrad with Picun as activists, was like about undocumented workers and about protecting the rights of undocumented workers. And I said, there's got to be a story here, right? This is it. And so I got in contact with Larry Kleinman, who I'd known from when I was an undergrad, and said, I'm writing this book and I want to tell this story. And, Bakun's going to be a big part of this, right? And so we started sitting down, and, Larry is somebody who is very conscientious about writing his own history and writing things down and documenting the history of the movement. And so he shared some of his writings with me, and we started talking, and the story of the Willamette Valley Immigration Project started to come out, right? And that this is the predecessor to Picun. And it really begins as an immigrants' rights movement, right? They're trying to chase down INS officers. They're trying to rescue people from deportation. They're doing all this, like, grassroots, in some ways, putting out fires of the increased raids that were happening in the Northwest, right? So statistically speaking, the INS was almost non-existent in the Northwest in the 1950s and 60s. Very few officers, right? The closest Border Patrol station was in Canada, right? And they had like 9 officers. And there was really not a presence until the late 1970s. And all of a sudden, or I shouldn't say late 1970s, until the 1970s, when all of a sudden you're seeing these ramps up of checkpoints, and tactics that have never been used in the Northwest. And so the Willamette Valley Immigration Project, which included Ramon Ramirez, Cipriano Ferrer, a guy named Juan Mendoza, Larry Kleinman, were all sort of converging on Oregon at the same time, and created the Willamette Valley Immigration Project, which is, I think, a fascinating story, right? They all converged on this small college in Mount Angel, Oregon, called Colegio Cesar Chavez, which was the first Hispanic-serving institution in the nation. And it was envisioned as this radical, non-traditional educational institution that was going to give credit to Mexicans and other people of color for their real life experiences, while also teaching them these other sort of college skills, right? So their first graduating class ended up conferring BAs to something like 19 or 20 Chicanos, right? And at the time, that was more Chicanos than both Oregon State and University of Oregon combined. Yeah. And so it was this really interesting kind of experiment. And, a guy named Carlos Maldonado, who was a professor at Eastern Washington, he passed away a few years ago, wrote a book about El Colegio, if people are interested in it. It tells a really interesting story. But for the purposes of what I was doing, it was a meeting point, right, between Larry, Cipriano, Ramon, and they all came together.
And Ramon is the president.
Yeah, the longtime president of Picun. And so, there was this kind of zeitgeist in the air, right, about revolutionary political organizing. And they met there and started to think about, well, what's the community need, right? What's the community asking for? And the community was, at the time, very, very scared, right? There was this, I think, very similar to what's happening now, like large-scale raids. Immigrants felt really unsafe and felt targeted. And the WVIP was, engaging the INS in a way that I don't think other organizations at the time were. And I think that they were really groundbreaking in that sense. And they were trying to develop legal strategies for undocumented immigrants, right? And they end up actually setting precedent, right, for the defense of undocumented immigrants. And, they go through this whole thing where they create these, like, study groups. None of them are immigration lawyers, right? They have this kind of study group feel, and they're reading everything they can, and they're sort of hypothesizing these different versions and ideas of what they could do to, like, slow down the INS and, stop the raids. And, they first want to say, okay, well, these are, illegal search and seizures, but there is no protection against that, or due process, and there's no protection against that because these are not criminal offenses. They're theoretically civil offenses, right? And so they ultimately end up pioneering the strategy of using the Fifth Amendment defense against deportation. So because most people don't carry around their birth certificates or proof of citizenships in their pockets, oftentimes the only admission of undocumented status is an admission from the immigrant themselves. And so they start to hand out these Know Your Rights cards. They start to do, you know, these bilingual, well, I should say Spanish language, flyers and workshops, and saying, if you get arrested by the INS, do not sign a voluntary departure form, right? And do not admit that you're an undocumented immigrant. The burden of proof lies on the INS to prove that. And so that becomes a case called Matter of Garcia. It becomes precedent in immigration courts. It's still used to this day. And so they really kind of set the foundation, right, I think, of what becomes a really vibrant immigrant rights movement from, you know, that spreads across the country, right? I mean, it's not until the 1990s that SEIU and Justice of Janitors and others are organizing undocumented people, while Pagun was doing it, you know, in the 1970s. And they'll, you know, they give credit to organizations like CASA, which was the Centro de Acción Autónoma Social, right, in California, as sort of the intellectual architect of what they were trying to do. And so, you know, they really set this precedent that becomes really important for the immigrant rights movements that emerge in later years. For them, however, like, they kind of struggled with that, what they sort of felt was an unsustainable model, right? Chasing after the INS and, you know, trying to beat them to, you know, the jails and trying to get to the workers before, you know, they say anything, and, you know, trying to get these stays of deportation. And they finally sort of at some point made the decision with IRCA, that with the Immigration Reform and Control Act, that that we have to become a union, right? We have to fight for these workers' rights, because even if we get them stays of deportation and they get to stay here, you know, they had these immigration workshops where they were, you know, filling out papers and applications and all these different things. And, you know, they were sort of doing this model of, like, that UFW used to use for, like, tax preparation and things like that, to get, you know, fill out forms for immigrants and do the immigration work, the social service work. Like, even if we do all that, they still have to go to work for these people, right? These farmers, these growers. And at that moment, they decide we need to transition into being a union. And that happens with IRCA in 1986, right? They really kind of plan around using the base group of people that become naturalized as their base members, right? And that's the birth of the Farm Worker Union, right? And talking to Larry, you know, there's very few people who know that story, right? Like, the people who were involved in the movement at the time know about the Willamette Valley Immigration Project, and nobody else does, right? And so when me and Larry started talking about me writing this book, it became this sort of thing where, you know, what's important here is to talk about these lessons, right? To talk about these important struggles and these strategies and these things of, like, you know, the structure of what they did and how it's original and how it was dynamic and how it was effective. Because, you know, people in the Midwest or in Florida or in other parts of the country that are trying to organize farm workers, I think this is an incredible story, right?
Do you see key differences between farm workers organizing in California and in Oregon?
Yeah, I mean, the key difference is that they organize undocumented workers, right? I mean, the UFW had a strong anti-immigrant stance in the 1960s. They, you know, did some really terrible things, like in terms of collaborating and colluding with the INS to raid camps, to, you know, they would report landlords that were renting to undocumented immigrants. They had these things they called the wet line, where they would send UFW members to the border to beat up undocumented immigrants who were crossing the border. And that was all run by Cesar's brother, Manuel, right? Manuel Chavez did all that stuff. And, you know, this is all really well documented by Miriam Powell, Matt Garcia, Frank Bardicky, who have all written these really important books on the UFW in the last 5 or 10 years. And, you know, my work in the archives at Wayne State of the United Farm Workers corroborates all of that, you know, and there's documentation of all the work that they did that was anti-immigrant. I think part of what made Picun successful and what made Picun different was that they knew the reality of who was working in the fields, and it was undocumented workers. And, you know, you had to organize who was there. And again, this is a big influence of CASA, right? And CASA, back in the 1950s, had a mantra that was, con o sin papeles, los trabajadores hacen la riqueza, right? With or without papers, workers create wealth. And so, you know, this was, you know, some, you know, whether we're talking all the way back to the Wobblies about international workers of the world, like, there was an identity as workers that superseded any national identity or citizenship. And CASA carried that through the 1950s, and I think Picun picked that up in the 1970s, right? 70s and 80s. And so there's a very distinct difference. And, you know, I think some people would take umbrage, but to me, the reality of it is that the UFW is largely ineffective as farm worker organizers today. And I think that has everything to do with their decision to, you know, ultimately have an anti-immigrant stance in the 1960s and 70s.
So I've been talking today with Professor Mario Cifuentes, who's assistant professor of history at the University of California, Merced. And we've been talking about his new book, Of Forest and Fields, Mexican Labor in the Pacific Northwest. So if you'd like to learn more about the book, you can access it at...
Rutgers University Press, their website. You can also buy it through my website, mariocifuentes.com. And then there'll be, you know, coupons on, you know, discounts on buying it that way.
Okay, brilliant. Yeah. Thank you so much for talking with me today.
Right.
This has been Desiree Hillers for the Old Mobile Radio Hour.
Come all ya good workers, good news to you, I'll tell of how the good old union has come in here to dwell. Which side are you on? Which side are you on? My daddy was a miner and I'm a miner's son, and I stick with the union till every battle won. Which side are you on? Which side? Lousy scab, or will you be a man? Which side are you on? Which side are you on? Don't scare for the bosses, don't listen to their lies. All those poor folks haven't got a chance unless we organize. Which side are you on?
Which side are you on? That was Dropkick Murphy. You're listening to KBOO Portland, and this is the Old Mole Variety Hour. Continuing with today's theme of workers and labor, Fran Michel is reading from an article entitled The Meaning of Work in a Sustainable Society by John Bellamy Foster. Can the current paradigm be modified, or is a whole paradigm shift in the way we think about work required? Fran?
Thank you, Tom. Good morning. As John Bellamy Foster writes, the nature and meaning of work as it pertains to a future society has deeply divided ecological, socialist, utopian, and romantic thinkers since the Industrial Revolution. Some radical theorists have seen a more just society as merely requiring the rationalization of present-day work relations, accompanied by increased leisure time and more equitable distribution. Others have focused on the need to transcend the entire system of alienated labor and make the development of creative work relations the central element of a new revolutionary society. In what appears to be an effort to circumvent this enduring conflict, current visions of sustainable prosperity, while not denying the necessity of work, often push it into the background, placing their emphasis instead on an enormous expansion of leisure hours. Increased non-work time seems an unalloyed good and is easily imaginable in the context of a no-growth society. In contrast, the very question of work is fraught with inherent difficulties, since it goes to the roots of the current socioeconomic system, its division of labor, and its class relations. Yet it remains the case that no coherent ecological mapping of a sustainable future is conceivable without addressing the issue of Homo Faber, that is, the creative, constructive, historical role in the transformation of nature, and hence the social relation to nature that distinguishes humanity as a species. Within late 19th century socialist utopian literatures, it is possible to distinguish two broad tendencies regarding the future of work, represented on one side by Edward Bellamy, author of Looking Backward, on the other by William Morris, author of News from Nowhere. Bellamy, standing for a view familiar to us today, saw enhanced mechanization together with comprehensive technocratic organization as the basis for increased leisure time, considered the ultimate good. In contrast, Morris emphasized the centrality of useful, enjoyable work, requiring the abolition of the capitalist division of labor. Today, the mechanistic view of Bellamy more closely resembles popular conceptions of a sustainable economy than does Morris's more radical outlook. Foster contends in his essay that the idea of near-total liberation from work is ultimately incompatible with a genuinely sustainable society. And he concludes that the real potential for any future sustainable society rests not so much on the expansion of leisure time, but on its capacity to generate a new world of creative and collective work controlled by the associated producers. Foster arrives at his rejection of the fantasy of fully automated luxury communism by tracing ideas of work from ancient through classical, Marxian, and later socialist ideas, and through extended consideration of the works by Bellamy and Morris. Morris's vision has been criticized by some as overly romantic, backward-looking, agrarian, and incompatible with advanced technology. But Foster emphasizes its congruence with Marx's ideas of unalienated labor, which requires new, higher forms of social production under the control of the associated producers. In Harry Braverman's 1974 book Labor and Monopoly Capital, The Degradation of Work in the 20th Century, Braverman documented how the rise of scientific management under monopoly capitalism, as exhibited in the work of Frederick Winslow Taylor's 1911 Principles of Scientific Management, had made the formal subsumption of labor to capital into a real material process. The centralization of knowledge and control of the labor process within management allowed for an enormous extension of the detailed division of labor and thus enhanced profits for capital. What Braverman called the general degradation of work under monopoly capitalism captured the material basis of the growing alienation and de-skilling of working life for the vast majority of the population. Alienation and the degradation of work were not inherent in modern work relations, but enforced by priorities of profit and growth. Foster argues that the essence of a future sustainable socialist society must be located in the labor process. Not only do human beings need creative labor in their roles as individuals, they also need it in their social roles, since work is constitutive of society itself. The wholesale cessation of labor as represented in many post-work schemes could only lead to a kind of absolute alienation, the estrangement from the core of life activity, which requires that human beings be transformative agents interacting with nature. To abolish work would constitute a break with objective existence in its most meaningful, active, and creative form, a break with human species being itself. The notion that the maximization of leisure, luxury, and consumption is the primary goal of human progress, and that people will refuse to produce if not subject to coercion and driven by greed, loses much of its force in light of the deepening contradictions of our overproductive, overconsumptive society. The prevailing view goes against what we know about many pre-capitalist cultures and falls short of a realistic conception of variable human nature, one that takes into account the historical evolution of human beings as social animals. The motivation to create and to contribute in one's life to the social reproduction of humanity as a whole, coupled with the higher norms enforced by collective labor, provide powerful stimuli for continuing free human development. The universal crisis that marks our time necessitates an epoch of uncompromising revolutionary change, one aimed at harnessing human energy for creative and socially productive work within a world of ecological sustainability and substantive equality. In the end, there's no other way in which to conceive a truly sustainable prosperity. That's from John Bellamy Foster's essay in Monthly Review on the meaning of work in a sustainable society. Or, as Audre Lorde puts it in her essay on the uses of the erotic, the principal horror of any system which defines the good in terms of profit rather than in terms of human need, or which defines human need to the exclusion of the psychic and emotional components of that need, the principal horror of such a system is that it robs our work of its erotic value, its erotic power and life appeal and fulfillment. Such a system reduces work to a travesty of necessities, a duty by which we earn bread or oblivion for ourselves and those we love. Within the celebration of the erotic in all our endeavors, my work becomes a conscious decision, a longed-for bed which I enter gratefully and from which I rise up empowered. For the Old Mole Variety Hour, this Labor Day, this has been Fran Michel.
That concludes our program for today. That was, once again, Dropkick Murphy with a song called Worker's Song. You've been listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Tom Becker. Patsy Kohlberg has been our engineer. Tune in next week for more commentaries and interviews from the Old Mole perspective. An attentive listener has called in to inform us that in the Bill Resnick, Mark Bray interview, one of them referred to the International Workers of the World. He corrected us. It should be the Industrial Workers of the World. Now, you can either listen to the entire program or specific segments in the next day or two on the KABU website. You can also find links to more information about guests and topics as well as past programs. Stay tuned now at 10. It's Locus Focus. Barbara Bernstein presents Sacrifice Zones. As the fossil fuel industry turns up its pressure to turn the Pacific Northwest into a fossil fuel export hub, a green thin line stands in the way. And at 11, we present a Labor Day special documentary, Universal Basic Income, an idea whose time has come. What is it, and what effect might it have on society?
KBOO Portland.